And so if you read in the 21st chapter of Revelation, you will find that those 144,000 are likened unto the wall and 12 gates of that wall. A few years ago, some idiot came up with the idea that 12 gates represented 12 different ways into the kingdom of God, and the Catholic Church was one gate, and these other denominations was other gates, and you could pick your own gate, which is foolish. That's of course Israel, and of course I'm not going into that. But anyway, this wall seems to indicate the separation from fellowship. Now again, separation from evil, separation from a number of other things, and indeed separation from the earth dwellers. Because 144,000 is a definite part of the church, which is the heavenly seed of Abraham. All right, now then, verse 11, immediately after this, we find that it's not said too much, if she be a door, we will enclose her. But that door seems to indicate that the way of salvation will be through the Jew. They will evangelize the world after that particular time. Verse 11 brings it out a little bit more, I believe. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon, and let out the vineyard unto keepers. Everyone for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. Now this vineyard, again, is Israel, and it seems that the vineyard, or the keepers rather, was to the Gentiles. And this is exactly what God did. He put the Jews in the hands of the Gentiles for a time. But, verse 12, my vineyard which is mine is before me. Thou, Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof 200. And so, to me, it seems, well, verse 13, thou dwellest in the gardens, the companions hearken to thy voice. Seemingly, again, the Gentile nations that must be in subjection unto Christ. And it corresponds most wonderfully with what we read in Philippians 2, how that every knee is going to bow and to acknowledge him as King of kings and Lord of lords. Verse 14, make haste, my beloved, be thou like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. And this just signifies that he will be over the mountains. He will be over all of the nations. He will reign as God Almighty and then have complete victory after that, his complete victory over all of his enemies. All right, that's about it. Does anyone have any questions? Now, the little sister seems to speak here of if she is a wall of the 144,000. If she's a door, it speaks of those earth-dwelling Israelites. You see, there's two applications of that. There was the immaturity, and this is what you find in that parable of the 10 virgins, that 5 of them, they all went to sleep. But when that cry was given, there were 5 of them, they all woke up. But 5 of them were prepared and 5 of them wasn't. So those 5 that were prepared seem to indicate the 144,000, which will be present at the wedding feast in the air. The others had to go and get some oil in their vessels, which corresponds with being filled with the Spirit. When they came in, then the door was shut and they said, I don't know you. But you see, they were still filled with the Spirit. So they will be the earth dwellers, taking the gospel unto the nations. They will undoubtedly be the nucleus of that. But, of course, the whole nation will become God's evangelist. Now, if you can see that, that is well and good. And as I said, I'm not meaning to contradict anyone, but this is the way that I can surely see this book without, this chapter, without stretching the imagination. And I also have... If you want to read that, Sister Mooneyhan had some notes on the Song of Solomon and the Grace and Glory a few years ago, and she brought it out for the most part this way at that time. Okay.
This is class 29, and we're starting in Jonah.
Tonight, I'm going to take 2 of the prophets. I generally try to stay away from the prophets because that's an altogether different course, and yet we overlap many of those things in this class. But these 2 particular prophets are very interesting. One, in the simple fact that it deals with Israel, and especially of Israel, so this is about one particular thing, anyway, that we learn about Israel after that they go into captivity. Our history of Israel over in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah have dealt with Judah. But this is Israel itself, the 10 tribes that is spoken of here in the book of Hosea. So, the other book that we will be considering is the book of Jonah. And I take this one because he is so typical not only of the nation of Israel, but also a wonderful type of Christ, as we will notice when we get to that book. There are also some beautiful personal lessons in these books for us, and we trust that we can get a few of those out of here. So the book of Hosea, first of all, Hosea is just another word for Joshua, meaning the same thing as Joshua does in the Hebrew, of course. And the theme of the book is God's love for Israel. God's love for Israel. All right, in verse 2, the beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and the children of whoredoms, for the land has committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. Now, in this you will find that Hosea is not only a prophet by the words which he spoke, that is, the spoken word as God would give a message to these different prophets and tell them something, but Hosea is a prophet by his very life, as we are going to notice. And so, in this particular portion, he is actually figurative of God, and what he did is prophetic of what God is going to do for the nation of Israel. The woman that he takes here, take unto you a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms. Now, Hosea, wonder of wonders, the man was instructed to go out and marry a harlot. And so you see what things that God called upon his prophets to do, and nevertheless, this is what he did. And so in verse 3, he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bore him a son. And then the Lord told him, you name this son Jezreel. Now this Gomer is a picture of Israel in her idolatry. She was a harlot insofar as God was concerned. She had committed spiritual fornication. And we know how that they had done that, how that they had bowed down to other gods, been in submission, subjection unto them, and they had gone away from the Lord. This was the reason that God allowed them to go into captivity. Now, as you've also learned in your prophecy studies, that prophecy has a local fulfillment as well as a far-reaching fulfillment. And so the things that he spoke of here spoke of them, but also a greater fulfillment even down beyond our time, as we will notice. Because Jezreel, in verse 15, says, shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And so Jezreel is actually the place, as we have seen before, it's the place of the Battle of Armageddon, and it tells us of that great and terrible battle that will end all battles. And if God did not stop the bloodshed, then man would annihilate himself right there. And so this son is given unto Israel to show that forth, named Jezreel. All right, then, in verse 6, she conceived again, and she bore a daughter, and God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah. For he says, I will have no mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by the bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now it seems to me that here we have a look into the local fulfillment, because Judah, you remember, was given a certain amount of freedom. God did not free Israel or Judah from the Babylonian nor the Medo-Persian empires by force. They were just absolutely given their freedom to go back down unto Jerusalem under Ezra and Zerubbabel and different ones like that. But we don't read, as I brought out before, and to my knowledge anyway, we do not read that the 10 tribes ever returned under their places at all. Well, they were actually more sinful than what Judah was, as we noticed when we studied the books of the kings. But here, this daughter is named Lo-Ruhamah, and it means unpitied. Unpitied. There is no mercy or no pity for them. So God gives this daughter in order to show just exactly that. And then she conceived and bore a son unto him, in verse 9. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ammi, for you are not my people, I will not be your God. And that's exactly what this means, not my people. So God has set Israel aside. For a time. But verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there shall it be said unto them, you are the sons of the living God. Now this seems to be a paradox, but of course we know exactly what it means, that God set Israel as a nation aside, and when these words, he says, you are the sons of the living God, it will be referring to Israel as a new creation when they are born again, after that they have endured all of the tribulation and the purging and the fire and so forth that they must go through in order to turn them back unto the Lord, because we will see that this is brought out even a little bit later on. All right, chapter 2 goes on with more of exactly the same thing, referring to this woman that is such an adulterous woman and being so very much against God. Verse 1, say you unto your brethren, Ammi, and to your sisters, Ruhamah. Now here again, it is reversed. The lo is taken off, and the lo in the Hebrew simply means not. So instead of not with mercy and not my people, now then he says it is going to be mercy and my people. All right. Now these will be their names in the end time, after that Israel has repented and after they have turned unto the Lord. Then of course they will, spiritually speaking, their name will be Ammi and Ruhamah. All right. But verse 2, plead with your mother, plead. She is not my wife, neither am I her husband. You see, this is God again speaking, and it also seems to be here that this was a literal fulfillment as far as Hosea's own wife was concerned. We'll notice a little bit more about that as we go on. All right, but insofar as Israel is concerned, and God says, plead with your mother, plead. She is not my wife. I'm not her husband. Let her therefore be put away, or put away her whoredoms out of her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked, set her as in the day she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. Now this is what has happened unto Israel at this time, how that God has set her aside. God has made her as a wilderness, and he did set her like a dry land, and he did slay her with thirst. She was still, you see, a people. No one has ever been able to annihilate the nation of Israel, but it was from 1948, I believe, that Israel again became a nation. But you see, you've never been able to kill the nation, but they were set aside for a time. Israel is the greatest proof of prophecy in the existence of God that there is. And you can just watch that nation and see how that they have fulfilled every jot and tittle of what God said was going to happen to them. Verse 6, he says, therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she shall not find her paths. And this is what God has done. Israel has struggled around in the dark, and they're still struggling around in the dark. He says, I will hedge up thy way with thorns. Well, I'm telling you, there is a thorny path over in Israel now. Even though that they are a nation, they have some kind of trouble over there in the Middle East. I was reading some things about the Libyans and the Arabs and those people in Time magazine, and there's nothing is cooled off as far as the animosity toward Israel. One man over there, I forget his name, but he's a leader in Libya. And he is a very, as you know, the greatest amount of our petroleum and oil is right over there in the Middle East, and especially in these Arab and Libyan countries. And this man has more bargaining power with his oil than with any other. And he treats people, and he sells to them, and he loans people money, for two reasons. How much what he called Islamic, how much of that they are, and how much they hate Israel. These are the two things that he goes by in order to loan them money. And so you find just the way it is here, that I will hedge up thy way with thorns, and Israel is in a thorny path at this time. Verse 7, she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. She shall seek them, but she shall not find them. Then shall she return, but then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, then it is better with me than now. And so this is what has happened to Israel, why they're going aside after the nations. The nations can help me. They've turned to the United States, and we rejoice that the United States has defended and befriended the nation of Israel, because that's how the nations are going to be judged. But you see, as far as Israel is concerned, they are trusting in the nations more than they are trusting in God. And what he says here is, she shall seek these different lovers, but she's not going to find them. Israel is not going to find all of her answers at the hands of these, even the friendly nations. Now, they cannot do that. And then it's where she says, I will return to my first husband. Well, who was her first husband? God himself. And so Israel is going to wake up to the fact that none of the nations can help her, and she must turn back unto the Lord. Verse 8, she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. That is, they absolutely wasted all of these provisions on idolatry. Well, you find this with Israel, and we've traced it down through our journeys, how that God met the needs of those people when there was seemingly no way to meet it. Why, even in the times of the kings, you remember how that there was a famine in that land, the city shut up, and yet God used the spoil of the enemy to feed that people in Elisha's time. So there are so many wonderful ways that God delivered them. All right, verse 9, though, then will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof, my wine the season thereof, recover my wool, my flax given to cover her nakedness. Now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of mine hand. I will also cause her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. I will destroy her vines and fig trees, whereof she has said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. So you see, she cannot really get everything from her lovers, but she has not come to a place of real repentance at this time, and God knows that. And so it is going to get much worse for Israel. It's going to get worse before it will get better. And so this is what he says. All of these things that she has laid to herself, that the nations have helped her with, in verse 12, all of that's going to be destroyed. The reward that she has, that has been given to her. And so forth, all of that is going to be destroyed. And then verse 14, therefore, says, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. Now, it seems to me this wilderness refers to that particular time in Israel's history, yet to come, a great part of the tribulation, where that God will bring Israel to a place of their need. We're in the second chapter of Hosea now, and in verse 14. So he says, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness, and then speak comfortably unto her. Now, you can trace this throughout Israel's history, and the same thing applies into our life, and that is that God leads people into a wilderness experience in order to break their will and cause them to be in submission and subjection unto him. And then he speaks comfortably unto them. That is, he shows them his mercy, shows them his grace, and so it will be for Israel. Verse 15, I will give her her vineyards from thence and the valley of Acre for a door of hope. Now, you remember this valley of Acre, it's the place where that Achan was stoned with stones, and it tells us here of judgment. And this is what must happen. Israel must be judged, as it were, before that she can really have what God has for her. And so it becomes a door of hope for her, as he says here. So that judgment, it's a terrible judgment. The tribulation, I'll tell you, the plagues that came upon Egypt are just a little foretaste, I believe, of the great judgment that is going to fall upon the nation of Israel. But notice that that tribulation actually is a door of hope for Israel. And why is that? Because that it turns Israel back unto God. And so it is that God uses this, and his grace is so marvelous that he leads Israel to this time of tribulation, not just to punish them, but to make them see their need of himself and to make them call upon him. And so the valley of Acre actually becomes a door of hope for Israel. The great tribulation actually becomes a source or a door resurrection, we might say, unto Israel as a nation. All right? And she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. In other words, she's going to be the victorious people that God intended that she should be. And what wonderful rejoicing that there was when they came out of the land of Egypt. You read over in the, I believe it's the 15th or the 17th chapter of Exodus, the song of Moses, and what a song they sang that day. And it was a wonderful song of victory. Well, they're going to be able to rejoice again. Verse 16, it shall be at that day. And, of course, this is very important because that day has not come at this point. But at that day, saith the Lord, thou shalt call me Ishi, and thou shalt call me no more Baali. All right, Ishi means my husband, and this is exactly what Israel is. They are the bride of Jehovah. Now keep in mind, there is a bride of Christ, there is a bride of Jehovah. Israel is the bride of Jehovah, and the bride of Christ comes out of the church. All right, and then they shall call me no more Baali. That means my Lord. In other words, they are going to have a much closer relationship with God than just as some far-off deity or Lord. But they're going to know him as their husband or Ishi. And whether I pronounced those words right or not, I don't know. But anyway, it means my Lord. See, Balaam is the same word. It's the plural of that, means my lords. And so he is Baali, my Lord. All right, verse 19, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. So you see that God intends to marry Israel with an everlasting betrothal. Now, over in the book of Matthew, you will find some instructions concerning marriage there, and people try to apply this to individuals in the church. But the book of Matthew, as we find there, does not speak of the marriage relationship in the church. That is given in Paul's gospel. What God is speaking of is the marriage between Israel and God, and how that they must come back and marry God, which is exactly what they will do. All right, so he says, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness, and in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercy. So this is God's marriage relationship with Israel, you see. Now, they have had some kind of an affair with all the rest of the nations, but it hasn't been righteousness, hadn't been judgment, and loving kindness, and grace. Verse 20, I will betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. And Israel, for the past, I don't know how many years, hadn't known the meaning of the word faithfulness unto God. But this time, you see, when they turn to the Lord, they will be betrothed unto him in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. Well, verse 23 is another expression, I will sow her unto me in the earth. That is, she will wander no more. She will be sown. She will be put down roots. But again, notice that Israel as a nation, regardless of what God does for her and how wonderful he makes her, she is still an earth dweller. Because she is sown in the earth, and it corresponds to the earthly seed of Abraham. And I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. I will say to them which were not my people, Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God. So this is a time after that Israel has been purged that they will return unto the Lord. Now then, there seems to be another expression of this in chapter 3. And it seems to me that this woman in verse 1 that he is speaking of is the same one that he married in chapter 1. And in order to stay with the type, I believe that we can see it. In verse 1, Then said the Lord unto me, that is, unto Hosea, Go yet, love a woman, beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress. Now this beloved of her friend is actually ex-husband. And so it seems that this woman, he married her as a harlot in the first place, and then even after that, she went away from him. And God told him to go back and marry her again. Well, I think I would be getting just a little bit tired of that woman if she'd been fooling around all over the place, and then you pick her up out of the dirt, and she gives you three children, and then she still plays the harlot. But you see, this is what Israel had done, and this is what God was trying to tell the whole nation by this little object lesson. And so what he says, Go yet, love this woman, beloved of a friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel. Even though Israel went away from the Lord time and time and time again, he always took them back. And this is the very secret of this book of Hosea, is that regardless of the sins of Israel, God has not forgotten his people and cast them away. He is still going to bring them back unto himself. And so we find here, they who took to other gods, they love flagons of wine. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver for an omer and a half of barley. And so here you find Calvary. This is how that God could bring this wife back unto himself, is by buying her at the cross. And this is what he did. He redeemed not only Israel, but all of humanity. But you see, especially in relation to this woman, he bought her at Calvary for these 15 pieces of silver. And then he says, I said to her, thou shalt abide for many days. You shall not play the harlot. You shall not be for another man. So I will also be for thee. The children of Israel shall abide many days without a king. Now then, we find after Calvary in verse 2, he says this to her in verse 3 in so many words, and this is what God wanted. He wanted Israel to be that loving wife unto him. He wanted her to be that loving nation and turn to him, but they did not do that. So in verse 4, the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, without a prince, without a sacrifice, without an image, without an ephod, and without a teraphim. Israel set aside during the church age after Calvary. And so you find it right there.